Hello, and thank you for listening to Unplugged Mom Radio. This is Laurette Lynn, your host, and you are listening to another edition in the series More Trivium with Gino Denning. If you haven't yet, then I encourage you to listen to the introduction to More Trivium with Gino Denning and Trivium and Intellectual Pilgrimage, just so you can get an idea of where we are headed with this series. And if you've already listened to it, I know that you're anticipating this installment, which is on grammar. This episode will cover the grammar stage of the Trivium model of learning and the Trivium concept of understanding. And just as a recap, so most of you know, and some of you may already know, the Trivium is a conceptual learning idea. It's not really a method. We talk about in the series a little bit why it's come to be understood as a method, but at its core, it really is a very organic way to learn and a very natural way to learn. Problem is that we have been programmed into an artificial way of learning, so this return home may seem a little awkward at first. Once you're there, though, it starts to seem more and more natural. So that's my experience, and I encourage everyone to give it a try because you'll see just how much it does resonate with your own organic humanity, so to speak, the more you allow yourself to be influenced by this. It dates back to Socrates and the great philosophers that really helped to shape modern civilization. It's a Socratic method of learning. It's a Socratic conception and principle based on natural human brain development. So when we allow ourselves, when we open up our mind and allow ourselves to absorb and really understand what's going on here, we find that it resonates more and more with our own natural vibration. Now, there are three stages to the Trivium. Then we move into the Quadrivium. And again, this all goes along with natural human progression. In the introduction, we kind of covered the basics of the whole thing. And we're going to go ahead and move forward now and cover the first stage, which is known as the grammar stage. There's grammar, logic, rhetoric. Now, the grammar stage can also be referred to as the discovery stage or the knowledge stage. You'll hear us refer to the Trivium in those three steps and also as knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Grammar being knowledge, logic being understanding, and rhetoric being wisdom. I've also used the terms discovery, understanding, and application. So this stage, the grammar stage, deals with discovery. Okay, now you'll see as we move along that this is how we learn everything in small ways. Every new idea that's introduced to us, we discover it, we understand it, and then we apply it. But when we're talking as a whole, as far as helping our children learn and grow, the first stage of their learning life up to puberty is the discovery stage. This is the knowledge stage. This is the grammar stage. And we're going to talk about that here. Now, I encourage you to seek out sources where you can explore this even more. Within this post, I'm going to suggest reading materials and further study so that you can really absorb this more and understand it more. But in this coming episode, we're going to give you an overview of the grammar stage. And I'm being joined by Gino Denning, who is really, he doesn't like to be called an expert, but he really is achieving expert level. He really knows a lot about this mode of study and this, he understands this pretty thoroughly. And I'm excited to be joined by him for this series. And I think you're really going to get a lot out of it, just as I did. So let's go ahead and give a listen to the grammar stage. Again, this is Laurette Lynn. From Unplugged Mom Radio, your host. And for more information, always check out unpluggedmom.com. Coming up, grammar. Give it a listen. Good morning, Gene, and thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing well, Laurette, and thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure. I want to say how much I enjoy your work, and it's exciting to be here this morning.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I am hoping to move in a better direction or a more improved direction based on what I've learned in my experience being this host and being able to offer the world this information. And I'm hoping that shows like this one will really contribute to that home improvement. So I'm very honored to have you on to talk about this because you are considered one of the top voices in Trivium learning and understanding Trivium and critical thinking. So I'm very pleased to have you on. I'm very excited to talk to you about this. I have a feeling that a lot of us are going to learn a lot today.
Well, I hope so. I've been practicing this since I was a child and an adolescent. I wouldn't consider myself an expert. It's that I just went back home before many of us did. The Trivium is really an observation, and it's the way our minds would naturally work. We observe something, we come to know it, and then we go to communicate it to others of our kind. And this is the way that we would normally do everything. Then when people become more proficient at the Trivium, when they understand more of it, they understand that they've been doing this all their lives, but it hasn't been in a systematic fashion. So it's the systematic nature of the Trivium. And by the way, this is the first three of the seven liberating arts. And I've come to call them the liberating arts because the term liberal has so many connotations in today's world. But the liberating arts are to liberate an individual's mind from ignorance. It liberates them from ignorance so that they can take a journey, so that they can go somewhere, so that they can go to understanding and knowledge.
Gene, I really like that you are using the term coming home and liberated. Coming home, it really resonates for me when we're talking about critical thinking and trivium, quadrivium, because when I was first introduced to this concept, that's how it felt for me. It felt so familiar, and it felt like this is something I always knew but never defined. This is something that I always felt but never refined. In other words, I think that we're all born naturally living life this way and thinking this way, and then between public schooling and the way our society is and the way our modern culture is and all of the artificial stimulation that we have, it's kind of stolen away from us or schooled out of us, so to speak. So this is really, to me, a return to the natural way that a human being processes information and understands their world before it was destroyed, before it was ruined out of us. And maybe that's why children adapt to it so much better, which is what I want to talk about today, helping children once we help ourselves understand this. And it's almost like I feel like there's not anything, especially with really young children, it's not so much of a procedure that has to be done to them as much as just to nurture what may already be there. And we have more of the learning to do, I think, because we're older. But that's why I also like that you use the term liberated. And I'm going to go back to the analogy of coming out of Plato's cave, because that's what this experience has been for me, even before I knew what it was, before I was able to define it. I knew that once I was able to open up my mind and get over my own ego and say, I really need to think about these things, I really need to question things, that's when, as difficult as some realities were for me to swallow at first, once I did, and once I was able to breathe that fresh air, I felt liberated. I felt free. I felt, okay, now that I know these things, now I am on my path to true freedom. And that one of the most important lessons I learned is that you keep going, you keep learning, and you keep acquiring. And it's just a matter of really having an open mind and being able to say to yourself, what is it that I'm dealing with here? What do I need to think about more here? And as I move along, I'm learning more and more about there is an actual process to critical thinking. And I'm enjoying it because I think that it's really improving my life vastly. So I'd like to touch on with you first, if we can just review quickly, what are we talking about when we talk about critical thinking, trivium, quadrivium, and a little bit about the seven liberating arts that you mentioned. And then once we establish that, I want to move into how parents can help children learn in this way.
Well, to go back to one of your comments, you say that we are born like this as humans. And what we're born with is the potential to have our mind work like this. Now, as you mentioned, as a child, as we're growing up from birth to about the time we start puberty, I want to go to a bit of the structure of the brain. And you touched on this with with Paul Verge when you did your first interview with him. And he was mentioning that there's a tissue that connects the two hemispheres, the right and left hemisphere, which I think everybody is familiar with. There's a tissue called the corpus callosum, which is made of myelin. It's the white tissue as opposed to the gray matter that we normally see on the exterior of the brain, or many of us are familiar with that. But this tissue called the corpus callosum, essentially from birth to age 11 or 12, whenever puberty starts, connects the two halves so that they're in very close communication. And what it essentially makes the brain is a storehouse. It's a warehouse of experiences and information. And this is why children have such ease at learning language. They're very comfortable at language-based subjects, including various and different languages. So what they're doing is just putting data into their brain. This is what living life as a child is. It's curiosity. It's putting it in there. Now there's a comprehension, but it's a very low level comprehension. It's just a comprehension of how these imaginative ideas get in there, and they have vivid connections, but they really don't have an understanding. And so this is the time to let them explore, to have them, as I say, pull in this data. Now, this data has not yet become comprehensive understanding. Now, there's a book out that I've recently become quite familiar with. It's called On Intelligence, and it was written by Jeff Hawkins and Sandra Blakeslee. And what it does is essentially go into the ideas that are explicit in the trivium, that our brain works first with taking in this information. And then what we look for is when we're trying to get more understanding. And understanding, by the way, comes in the adolescent stage, which is age about 11 or 12 to about 21, 22. And there are some actual physiological changes that take part in the body and the brain. Of course, we're all familiar with the onset of puberty and the development of our reproductive, our sexual capacities.
Sure.
But it's much more than that. The brain goes through tremendous changes. And one of the changes that occurs at this secondary level, this level of adolescence, is the corpus callosum starts to reconfigure itself. And what it's doing is breaking some of the connection between the two hemispheres of the brain. So this is when children start to become more independent. And of course, we see that at age 11 or 12. They start asking more difficult questions. The tenor of their questioning has started to change. There's an essay called The Lost Tools of Learning, which was written by Dorothy L. Sayers in 1947. And she pretty much explains the trivium in there, the idea of grammar, logic, and rhetoric. If you're not familiar with it, I would suggest that everyone who is a parent look it up on the internet. It's a relatively short essay. And in it, she tries to introduce some nomenclature that really wasn't available at that time. She calls the second level, the adolescent level, the PERT stage. This is when people start to become more independent. And the reason, the physiological reason, is this corpus callosum starts to allow the two hemispheres to operate a little bit more independently. So one hemisphere can hold data in mind, and the other hemisphere can actually process it as analysis. And it's said, there's a lot of new material being made public lately about brain development, and that a lot of the knowledge that was previously, and I don't mean that long ago, just as little as a decade ago, that some of that knowledge is incorrect. And I think that the new publications that are coming out are just adding to confusion.
Gene, can I ask you, you mentioned that the second level, the second stage for children ages 11 through 21, is their brain is changing, of course, and they're going through puberty and they start to become more independent. At that age, children often, you said that they ask more difficult questions, and that definitely is true. And I'm noticing also that they become more challenging, not challenging to the parents to parent them, but they themselves start to challenge their own preconceived notions or to challenge ideas about the world. Like you'll present them with information or the world will present them with information and they'll challenge it much more than they would have prior to that. They'll ask more challenging questions, deeper questions, and they'll almost demand proof and say, I don't know if I believe this anymore. They're not, as naive, I guess, or vulnerable to information. And does that, this is typically what a teenager is like. A teenager goes through this and we call it rebellion because they seem to be rebelling against everything society's telling them. But I think this is necessary. And I think it's very a very positive thing, and society maybe calls it a negative thing because we see teenagers as troublemakers, but they're really not. I think this is a natural thing that they're doing. They're questioning their world and they're challenging the information that they're being presented with. Does any of this resonate with you? Do you think this has to do with this natural change that they're going through? And do you think that society is doing kids a disservice that are in this age by trying to suppress that?
Well, that's what I was mentioning about Dorothy Sayers, is she tries to explain that children are taking the content, the data content that they have in their brain when they were younger, and now trying to understand it. Now, I'm connecting this to this book that I just mentioned on intelligence that was written by this Hawkins fellow who also developed the Palm Pilot. So he wanted to know the difference between what we have developed as computer technology and the way the brain actually works. And what he said is he gave a definition in his book for what intelligence is. Well, intelligence is pulling together data, holding data in memory. And then he says, he likens it, he uses the analogy of a person who has seen several large crowds of people in his life. And as children, you take children out to events where there are crowds of people. And they become conditioned to this. But if they see, and this is the analogy that Hawkins uses, he says, if a person sees another person in the crowd with two noses, everyone else blends into the crowd, but the person with two noses stands out. So understanding, he says, which is beyond just the idea of memory, understanding is finding the people with two noses in the crowd. Those are the things that stand out to us. This is exactly what logic is. You're finding the contradictions in there. So what adolescents are doing are taking some of this data that they're holding in their minds and discovering these people with two noses in there, these contradictions. Now, they see them as contradictions, and they want to know how to get rid of them so that they have a coherent view of the world. So all of the adolescent stage is building this ability to take the contradictions out of their mind. And it shows up as you say, rebellion. Now, I had some experience with presenting this material, this mostly the trivium, the first three of the seven liberating arts. A bit of the quadrivium, I really provide some books for that. Once people become cognizant of the trivium, they know how to teach themselves. So from here, they can teach themselves the quadrivium. And Jarrett Sanchez, in his interview with you, emphasized this, that a person can learn virtually anything by using this progression. This idea of grammar, putting the grammar together, taking the contradictions out through logic, and then passing it on to other people. And the thing that I want to say about this passing things on is that this in itself is a learning process, and I think Jarrett touched on this as well. But we're all familiar with the adage that the best way to learn is to teach, because again, you find more contradictions. And it's not a linear progression when we go through the trivium. We keep going back to data, back to grammar, back to finding the two-nose people in the crowd, taking them out, taking the contradictions out, and then refining our knowledge. Now, this period of adolescence, which many in contemporary society call the teenage years, and I think this is when that term came about, when that term replaced adolescence or puberty, the time of puberty, this idea of presenting adolescence as rebellious started to come about. As I say, I've been involved with some home-educated families and children. And what I found in presenting this to 12 and 13-year-olds, what I saw of them was not rebellion, but was ease with which they were taking in this information, and grace in processing it. I saw these adolescents as graceful people, because they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing at that age.
Mm-hmm.
They are integrating the data that they have as undifferentiated knowledge. The knowledge that they have is becoming whole within their minds. And this is a continual process. It goes on for the rest of life. But they when they initiate this internal dialogue, and that's actually what's happening when the corpus callosum starts to sever the connection. It never completely severs the connection between the right and the left hemisphere. But as it starts this, you begin an internal dialogue, an internal question and answer situation. And this is why logic, which really means the ability to see ratios, it has a number, logos, the Greek root logos, has a number of different connotations. One of them is that it's the ability to see and utilize ratios. Another is that it's word or letter. That logos is the word, and another is the word, a word that follows another word that follows another word forms a complete thought, or what we call a sentence. A sentence is really the first idea of a complete thought that humans have. So one thing follows another. And the reason that I use the term logic is that the term dialectic, which just means a dialogue, a dialectic is often used as a term along, synonymous with logic. And what it means is that you as an individual have this internal dialogue of question and answer. You're trying to take the data that you have, question it by taking out the contradictions, by taking out the two-nosed man, until you have this complete understanding. And this is what adolescence is for. And if you take people at that 11, 12, 13-year-old stage, you don't notice, as I say, so much the rebellion as an additional curiosity. And it's this crucial stage that government schools around the world are trying to arrest, this idea of bringing this internal conversation up to the level where it's actually doing the person some good. John Taylor Gatto, whom I know you have followed quite extensively,
yes,
has a term. He calls it active literacy. Now, when we're children, we can learn to read. We can learn to take alphabets and put them together and form designations, which are individual words, but a designation like bird, it all it does is designate something in reality. But it's not a complete thought. The bird flies is a complete thought. Now you get the idea that this entity, bird, does something.
Mm-hmm.
So bird is the subject. Flies is the predicate. Bird is the thing that you're talking about. Fly is the thing that you're saying about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a complete thought. And this is two-thirds of the way that we structure our thoughts. And it's usually subject, predicate, object. Object just completes oftentimes the predicate, what we're talking about. And the things that we say about subjects are simply actions and states of being.
Now you can, taking this very simple concept of just breaking this down and saying, okay, bird is the subject and the bird flies is what we're saying about the subject. If we broaden that to our understanding of the entire world and our society and the world that we live in on a more sophisticated level, it really just comes down to that root way of thinking and understanding the world around us is to break things down into subject and what is the subject doing. Does this apply at all to something that you had mentioned to me previously, which is Aristotle's 10 subjects? Pretty much what I'm gleaning from that when I read it is I'm understanding that the idea is that anything that needs to be understood can be understood by these 10 subjects, by this list of 10 criteria. And if we can explain it by these things, that means that we understand it thoroughly.
Well, Aristotle's 10 categories, and if you do a word search or go to Wikipedia, you'll see the 10 categories. Now, the 10 categories should be presented right about puberty. Let me go back to grammar, general grammar, and relate a personal situation that I was taught grammar by my mother when I was age 9 in a one week period of time. She went to school in southern New Mexico in the 1920s. She was in elementary, or what we call, or what they called, primary schooling. They called it the grammar school at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the way that people were taught. When I started school, I had, in the first and second grades, I had all the childhood diseases, and I was unable to read. By the time I got to third and fourth grade, I was unable to read because they were using whole word methods of teaching you how to read rather than phonetic, rather than giving you the phonetic code so that you could take letters, which represent phonemes. Letters are graphemes, which represent the smallest sound that you can make, that you can utter, and these are phonemes.
Mm-hmm.
Put the phonemes together and you have the code for putting individual or designations together. Bird starts with a B-I-R-D. Onomatopoeia. If you just look at that from whole language, you've got to memorize the whole thing in order to look it up if you don't know what it means. But if you can sound it out, it makes more of an impression on your brain. So at any rate, I get to fourth grade. My fourth grade teacher calls my mother in after we introduced ourselves in class that first day in school, and we read from a text, and I was the worst reader in the room. And my mother had suspected that something was amiss, that I was having problems with reading for a reason. And she found out what whole word was because she was taught phonetically in school. So she says to the teacher, "Leave it to me. I'll take care of it." Now, if I were that child in class today, I would be diagnosed with one of the maladies that have suddenly popped up. Deficiency in attention deficiency or some other thing that required drugs. All she did was, over a period of 3 or 4 months, teach me how to sound out words. And then I went from being the worst reader in class to being about average in the middle of the semester to at the end of the year, I was the best reader in the class. But because she gave me this code, I suddenly gained tremendous respect for my mother. You know, at age 9, you're already starting to think that you know it all. But I said to her, you know, Mother, now that I find that reading is actually fun, not only is it fun, but it's informative. It just opens up entire vistas to you. And I was appreciative of that vista because it happened relatively suddenly to me, especially after having a problem with reading. And so I became tremendously enthused about reading. And I said, but the problem, one of the problems that I see is I really don't like these rules that they keep trying to get us to memorize, this stuff called grammar.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, okay, well, I'm going to drive you to school on Monday. And I'm going to point some things out to you, and I want you to just respond. And she says, this is the way we were taught grammar when I went to school. So we got in the car, and she pointed. She says, what's that? She pointed next door, and I said, that's a house. She says, what's next to it there? And I said, well, that's a car. And what's that growing in the front yard? And I said, well, that's a tree. And what's that underneath the tree? That's a lawn. So she pulls out of the driveway, and she's just pointing things out. That's a post box. That's a picket fence, so on and so forth. And I was getting a little bored with this, but I decided to stay the course. And she starts driving me up to the school. And in those days, we didn't have buses that took us to school. It was usually high schoolers that took the bus. And it just wasn't cool for your parents to drop you off at school. We all walked to school. We were all taught in those days that if we didn't pay attention to those big things going down the road, those 3,000-pound cars and those 12,000-pound trucks, if we made contact with them, we would lose. So kids were much more focused on the sidewalk in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So we walked to school, and we'd meet other of our friends, and we'd chat as we went to school. But as I say, it was just not cool to have your parents drop you off at school. So I said, well, drop me off 2 blocks away.
Yeah, it was like that for me as well.
Okay. Okay. It's good to hear that that's...
Yeah, it was.
That's still a model.
I lived pretty close to, I grew up in Brooklyn, and I lived pretty close to the school building. So by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I was walking there on my own anyway. And my mother would like stand by the window or stand by the front door, and I would shoo her away and say, my friends will see you.
Well, as I asked her to drop me off a couple of blocks away, I said, I didn't use these words. What was the purpose of this exercise? But I said, what was that all about?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I'm glad you asked. She says, what you pointed out today were nouns. I said, nouns? Yeah. She said, all those things that I pointed to were nouns. And a light just went off in my head. You mean nouns actually have something to do with reality?
Outside rules, of the book.
Yeah. These rules actually have something to do with something practical. Of course, I didn't say that. It was just this vague feeling. It's very much like you're saying that you're familiar with the trivium process. It was, well, gosh, I now have a relationship with nouns. So the next day, we go out, and she essentially points out pronouns, discusses with me what pronouns are. And so now I have this idea that general designations,
mm-hmm.
he, she, it, them, stand in for nouns. So now I have a relationship with pronouns. And she said, okay, tonight we're going to eat dinner a little bit later, and we're going to go over the different types of nouns or substantives. She used that word, substantive. So I got home, and she says, okay, we're going to look at things today in the house. Like, what's that over there? I said, that's a chair. What's that? That's a table. What's that? I said, that's a bureau. She says, what would you call them all put together? And I said, well, I guess you're trying to get me to answer furniture. And she says, that's right. Now, furniture is a noun, but I can't point to furniture. I can point to pieces of furniture, but there are things in your mind that you hold in your mind that are actually mental things. And the next indication of this is she said, is it true if you hold an apple above the floor and let go that it'll fall to the floor? And I said, yeah, that's true. Then she said, well, is it true that Santa's reindeer, Rudolph, has a red nose? I said, yeah, that's true. And she says, now, do you see the difference here? One is a physical truth and the other is a mental truth. And the only reason this idea of Rudolph having a red nose is true is that it's published. It's known amongst a bunch of people. Now, this, she says, is where we agree upon things being. Mental things are agreed upon. Physical things are what we observe, what each of us see as being true in reality.
Gene, I have to interrupt you one second because I'm listening to this and I'm finding it so profound, and it's one of these moments that the simplicity is what I find so profound, because it's so simple to most of us, especially as adults, to just take this kind of thing for granted and not really understand the lesson that we're learning here, or the profound nature of it, is to say, yeah, okay, I get it. A chair is a chair, a table is a table, and furniture is furniture. But when you take it outside of that in and of itself and apply it to your entire life and everything that you observe in life, and when you take this same understanding of how to observe your world and differentiate between something mental and something cement, and you use that and you exercise that when you're out in your world and living your life as an adult and watching political debates and watching what's going on in your society and trying to make a decision about your family, and you're able to kind of subconsciously exercise this same understanding, it really does have a profound impact and influence on making your life more positive and enjoying your life more. Because, I mean, really think about what you're saying there. Is we can, when we think about furniture, when I think about furniture in my mind, I don't think about anything in particular. I just have a mental grouped image of kind of chairs, tables, couches, sofas just flying around in my mind. But when I think about a chair, I think about a chair.
Right.
You know, and there is, I think that that relates to everything in our lives. So it's not just about understanding how to formulate a sentence. It's so much more profound than that.
Well, formulating a sentence, again, like the trivium, is a complete thought. It's not a bunch of rules as to how to properly formulate a sentence.
It's how to think completely.
Exactly. Let me continue with this, because adults in particular, at some point along the lines of this story, a light bulb does go off. So let me go on to Wednesday. We went from having a personal relationship with nouns and pronouns to making a differentiation between the physical universe and the mental universe, and how nouns are physical things and mental things. To the next day, we go out, and she points to the same things. We get in the car, and she points to the car next door, and she says, what is that? And I said, well, that's a car. What's it doing? I said, well, nothing. It's parked. And then just then a car starts driving down. She says, there's another one of those things. What is it? It's a car. What's it doing? I said, it's moving. It's driving. She says, okay, we're going to point out today. She didn't keep the suspense going. She said, you just described verbs. A verb is an action, the car driving down the street, or a state of being, the car that's parked. So these are verbs. So we go down the street and she points at a dog. It's running. She points at a tree. It's planted. So all day long, we're going along, and she's showing me actions and states of being. And she said, these are verbs. This is what you say about nouns, that the car is parked or the car moves. This is a complete thought. Before, when we were just talking about nouns, they were just designations, cars, birds, houses. We talk about verbs, and they're just actions, moving, still, or states of being, actions and states of being. So, but you put them together, and you've got the first complete thought. She drops me off at school. Next day, she says, okay, today I'm going to point to the same things, and I'm going to ask a slightly different question. So we pull out of the driveway. She points at the same house. What color is that house? I said, white. What color is the car? I said, red. There are two dogs across the street. Describe them. Well, one's bigger than the other. One's small. She said, okay. Look at that tree. I said, oh, that's a dry, dead tree. Look at the tree right next to it. Oh, that's a vibrant, living tree. So again, she doesn't keep the suspense going. She says, what you were describing to me are attributes. You're giving me a description, a more thorough description of what those nouns are. And she says, I'm going to ask you, when we get out here to the boulevard at the major intersection, another question. We were just about there. And she says, look at the cars going along with us as compared to the ones on the boulevard. And I said, well, the ones on the boulevard are going much faster than we are. She says, okay, you have just described more thoroughly an action. So what you've just given me is an adverb. This was also an attribute of motion or states of being. So what we've been pointing out here are adjectives and adverbs. Voila. I now had a personal relationship with adjectives and adverbs because they meant something in my world, in the world that we all share. I have a personal relationship with adjective, adverbs, verbs, nouns, and pronouns. So this is Thursday. And she says, okay, tomorrow we're going to go out and see the final stage of a complete thought. So we drive out, and the neighbors are walking out, and I just happen to know that the relationship between the neighbors. She says, okay, who is that? And I said, oh, well, that's Jane and her uncle. And I said, she asked, what's that on the roof of the house? And I said, well, that's the chimney. And she says, where is the chimney, the top of the chimney located? I said, above the roof. Okay, she said, what we just described were relationships.
Prepositions.
Prepositional phrases.
Right.
Prepositions are actually the words that are that tie ideas together. But the prepositional phrase describes relationships.
Mm.
So now I have a relationship with relationships. And of course, we drove on and things were underneath, next to, above, so on and so forth. So we had relationships. And she says, these are the basic items that you need to know of the nine grammatical basics. And she says, these are the things that exist in reality. And she says, the other things, like the preposition itself, of or from, are things that exist much like furniture does, as things in our minds. And they're just ideas. They are things, but they're ideas. And as are conjunctions, things that we use for unit economy, and, therefore. This is another one of the nine basics of grammar. Now, what I want to bring forth here is all of these. This is why this is called general grammar, because it doesn't matter what language you're using. Every language, if it's fully developed, has all of these parts to it. So it doesn't matter what language you're speaking, you can call this general grammar. And also there are subjects like biology, which have been developed. They're formal subjects. They're subjects which have been formed. And biology has its own nomenclature, its own language, essentially. So you can talk about botany and zoology and the various parts of the life sciences as a grammar in itself. So this is what general grammar refers to, these things, these actions, and these relationships in reality.
It's the foundation, in other words.
It is the foundation.
And that is why we teach it, or we help children understand it at an early age. And what I'm enjoying about listening to this is you essentially learned this and understood this and had this understanding of life. And there's two special things about this. The fact that it happened in a week's time and that this light bulb went on for you and you understood it in a week's time, whereas when we go through the schooling process, and it is a process, it's an artificial procedure, kids will spend probably 3 or 4 semesters on this, and it's all done with the book. It's not done in reality. It's not done out in the street like your mom did it with you. It's all just in one-dimensional kind of experience, or a two-dimensional experience in a book where they're reading a sentence and circling which one is the verb, you know, and they're going over this and over this and over this again and again and again and again, to the point where it's almost nauseating, I think. And another thing that's special about this is not only did you understand it in such a short period of time, but you understood the relationship beyond the page. You understood how it applied to your life and to reality and to everything else that you're going to absorb. And even if you didn't know you understood it at that age, you did understand it, because then as you went through your life, you probably were able to have a more crisp understanding of the world around you because you had this foundation. And that's what I mean when I say that learning grammar is so much more than sentence structure. It is sentence structure. And that structure is you're creating a complete thought, but it's also training you in having a complete thought and to observe things more completely. And with all the when you go to school and you go through this, the way that they teach things, and yeah, many schools don't teach phonetically anymore. And I do think that that's a problem, because you're not really connecting those synapses to the sounds. You're not connecting the sounds. You're just looking at a word and trying to memorize it. And yes, that causes problems later that they label as ADD. But the kids are really failing to be able to take this understanding and use it. They know, okay, if I want to form a sentence, I have to say more than the dog. I have to say the dog runs fast, and then I have a complete sentence. But they're not really getting why that's important, and they're not relating it to the way that they think, you know. And I think that's what's important about the way that you learned and what we're able to deliver to other people when we start talking about critical thinking and the trivium, is that it really is preparing us for a more profound understanding of our world by training us to have complete thoughts. Does that make sense?
Well, profound is one way of putting it. To put it less grandiosely, we can also say that it gives us clarity of thought.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned going back to your observation that this was taught within a week. One of the major considerations here is not only that it was taught within a week, but each concept was given to me on one day. And then I had an entire night to sleep on it. So it's just as important to have the intermittent spaces to absorb these things into our subconscious, if you want to call it that. So you get one concept at age 8, 9, or 10, and then sleep on it. Then you're given another concept, which is related to it, the next day. So it's also important that you get this with spaced repetition. This is one of the things that that is just a good general piece of advice, to utilize spaced repetition. Jarrett Sanchez went over this with you in his interview about how to read a book, that you don't just read it once. You read it a number of times, and you read it in a different way each time. And there's an author named Susan Weisbauer who has mm-hmm. two books out. One is the Trained Mind. Are you familiar with her?
The Well-Trained Mind.
Because this goes back to Dorothy Sayers, Lost Tools of Learning as well. See, what you do with a person before he or she reaches puberty is you train them. You give them these ideas, and you don't ask them to analyze it. They'll come to their conclusions. They'll come to a low-level understanding, a prior understanding, and that's what reading is. Reading is actually, as John Taylor Gatto makes the distinction, reading is the passive literacy. If you only learn to read, you can comprehend what's on the page, but you can't comprehend the meaning underneath it, because you're not yet looking for the man with two noses. You're not yet looking for contradictions, either within your own understanding or within the understanding of the author. And that comes later. That comes at puberty. So the first thing we do is train people didactically. You just give them the information. You don't ask them to analyze it. You don't ask them what their opinion is of it. Here's the information. Here is what is. Just mm-hmm. just take it and put it into your storehouse, because the two hemispheres of your brain are acting as a storehouse right now.
And this is the grammar stage.
This is the grammar stage, and this is training. Now, again, I have to remind people that this is not a linear situation. You don't just start at that age with grammar. As you encounter life, living of life the rest of your life, you have to keep going back to grammar when you encounter something new. And this is why Jarrett Sanchez was saying you can learn virtually anything, because as you go through life, I mean, what is life? It's learning.
Right.
It's learning, understanding,
utilizing. You take yourself through the grammar stage first.
Right.
Give me the facts first.
Right. Then find the two-nosed people in there. Take mm-hmm. them out until you get understanding. And then you pass it on or discuss it with other people, and you refine your knowledge and so on and so forth.
And we have grammar, logic, rhetoric.
Right. You keep going back to training. Didactic. And then you go to the dialogue, the dialectic. And this is where you're looking for the contradictions or the two-nosed man. And now we can fast forward. I have this relationship. It's not dry rules that I have to commit to memory. I have a relationship with nouns, verbs, adjectives, adverbs, and prepositional phrases. So I fast forward now. And at age 13, I went to school in southern New Mexico, the hometown of my mother. And evidently, we were still behind the times in the 50s and 60s, because when I was age 13, in a social studies class, we were told by our teacher to go out and interview someone in a field that we might be interested in. Well, my mother was a nurse, and nurses always want doctors as sons. So she says, well, I don't want you to be up all night delivering babies and taking care of emergencies. She says, why don't you become a dentist? Because they have regular office hours. So I went to my family dentist, and my aunt, my sister's younger my mother's younger sister, was this dentist's assistant. So I went and interviewed him. And he knew that I was interested in doing things with my hands. I really enjoyed the culture of aviation and model airplanes and real size airplanes and all this stuff. But he saw some of the work that I'd done on assembling plastic model airplanes, and he liked my craftsmanship. He says, well, why don't you come in here every day after school and see if you like this work back here, the laboratory work. Here is where he said, this is where we make the artificial teeth and the various appliances and so forth. And it'll really challenge your craftsmanship, your ability to craft things. So I did, and I truly enjoyed it. Well, one of the things that he said is you have to start knowing the nomenclature. You have to start knowing the specialized language that we use here. So what was he saying? He's saying you have to learn the general grammar of dentistry, because it does have a specialized vocabulary. And he said, I'm going to ask you to do something almost entirely different. You're not going to know what the connection is. But he said, I've got a desk dictionary over here, and I want you to get a loose leaf notebook. Well, in fact, he gave me the loose leaf notebook. And he says, just go through here and start copying. Start with aardvark and copy the word, the pronunciation, and the definition. And then do that for the first three A's, and then go to B's and do that for B's, and so on down the line. Just copy it.
Uh-huh.
And he says, to motivate you, he says, you're going to be doing something that doesn't seem to be connected to anything else. But what it's going to do is open up pathways in your brain. You just made the reference just momentarily ago about the synapses.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, this is going to make connections in your brain that is going to allow you to perform in the world at a higher level. He says, just try it. So every day after school, I'd go over there, do a little bit of the work that I liked, and then sat down and copied this. And I must admit, I did not care for doing this. I only went through three iterations. I went from A to Z, three words at a time, once, A to Z, twice, A to Z, three times. This took me almost a year and a half because I wasn't all that keen on it.
Mm-hmm.
But as home educators, the first thing I would do is suggest to people, if they have children age 8 or older and adolescents, to relate this story, to go through this idea of relating nouns, verbs, attributes, adjectives, and adverbs, and so forth, spaced repetition over a 1 week period of time, and the parent himself, and even if your children are in public school, in government school, you can do this. This was done by my mother, and I relate that story to. I related that story to somebody recently, and people have become so literal. They said, do you mean that your mother's class back in the 20s all got together on a bus and took a No, I think they just went out into the schoolyard and toured the schoolyard. But this is how literal people have become. They just can't put things
I think it's a matter of having been conditioned that way.
Sure.
You know, because we're conditioned that way and we're taught that way. And that's why it's important to kids, when we have kids, if we don't want them to fall into the same traps, to kind of start out from scratch, you know, because people, I think, like we were saying before, we're kind of born with this natural ability and this natural functionality of our brain. And our role as parents is to help them exercise that and sort of build the brain muscle in critical thinking and understand and provide this understanding of grammar and this foundation so that they can think critically as they grow older. What happens to us as adults, it's kind of schooled out of us or conditioned out of us, and we have this kind of very one-dimensional understanding, and we take everything so literally because we can't think beyond that. We have an inability to think beyond that. But the good news is that it's possible for us, even as adults, to kind of go back and say, okay, I need to return to the grammar stage here because I need to really understand my world. And once we grasp this idea of the trivium, which is grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and it's like you were saying before, too, if I could go back to that for just a minute, and Jared had mentioned, once you have a cognitive understanding of what it means, of what grammar, logic, and rhetoric means, then you'll learn it, and you'll learn to think critically, and you'll be able to see the world in a different way, and you'll see things, new information that's presented to you, and you'll kind of automatically extrapolate, okay, what is the subject and what is the predicate, and I need to have a complete thought about this. And, you know, a lot of people today just aren't able to do that. And that's why they're questioning you and they're taking everything so literally. Again, though, like I said, the hope and the good news is that the ability is there. It's easier to start with children because they're more of a blank slate. They haven't been ruined, so to speak. But it is possible for teens and adults to go through this procedure as well. I think the most important thing is to be willing and open to do it. And I think we need to get over our ego first and say, okay, I may not know all there is to know. Let me go back to the basics and rebuild my foundation.
Well, that's why I'm saying anyone can do this without actually understanding. They can take their child out for a 1 week period of time. I wouldn't know where the minimum age is, but I would say around 8, 9 present this. And the parent may not know that they are building a plasticity of mind. And this is what I'm saying, the difference between someone who is completely literal and someone who does have this plasticity, who has more synaptic connections in the brain to connect the dots with. And that's what building the brain muscle, as you put it, is. It's giving you more and more choices. And you'll be able to make more and more connections because more and more connections are built in there. It's a snowball effect in the brain that's occurring. But the second easy thing to do is in early puberty is to have people go through a desk dictionary, not a big dictionary, but if you can complete a small dictionary, and it really doesn't even matter what the definition is. It's the idea that your brain is taking in this information at first to try to understand it and then to put it into the subconscious portions of the brain. But this idea of just copying, before the printing press came about, this is what learned people did. They copied manuscripts over and over. And today, or at least in the period of time when I was a young adult, we still had typesetters that would typeset newspapers and actually use little lead castings of letters to just put the words together on the typesetter, and then they'd print it out. Well, it turned out that typesetters at newspapers were some of the most well-informed people on the planet because they became self-educated just by this exercise of copying. And they developed a plasticity of mind. By doing something, which is copying, it affects all the other functions of your brain.
Now, I'd like to ask you a question while we're on this, and then we'll move on to a little bit more. But as you mentioned Susan Weisbauer, and I'm going to be interviewing her in the book, The Well-Trained Mind, and she also has The Well-Educated Mind. One of the exercises that she strongly suggests is very similar to this, and that is copying, taking yes. vocabulary words and their definitions and yes. copying. And she strongly encourages repetition and uh-huh. repetition, especially at that age, that kind of right before puberty and maybe into puberty, that age, that's what they should be doing. And she does suggest for the younger generation, for the younger people, not generation, for younger kids, to just kind of fill them with information. And then as they get a little bit older, the repetition and the copying. And she also suggests when we do reading, like if we're reading aloud as a family, to have younger children kind of reiterate it back to you so that they understood, you know, that they understood what you were discussing, but the older children should write it in summary and mm-hmm. even maybe write it again and again and again. Now, that is where I find that there are a lot of home educators out there, because I'm sure you know by now that there's this whole vast world of home education and this entire movement that considers themselves unschoolers. And within the unschool community themselves, there are variants in definition. It's very incohesive. However, I will find that a lot of the people that adhere to that kind of thought will strongly and staunchly reject this notion and reject Susan Weisbauer and, you know, say that her methods are mean and barbaric and they punish children and that you should never make children do that because it's boring and it's useless and it's repetitive and children don't like doing it and you should never force them to do something that they don't like to do because it's bad for them. So, you know, you have this kind of conflict now going on with the world of self-education, where one side of the coin is saying that this is important to exercise the mind, and another, the flip side, is saying, but it punishes children and it's mean, you know. And I've been dealing with this, and I've been having these conversations, and I've been trying to straighten it out in my own mind, and I think I have it all straightened out now. But I still continue to have these conversations with parents. And coming from where you're out and explaining all of this and listening to you, I wanted to know if you've heard of that, if you're aware that there are people that would consider that mean, and what your thoughts are on that. Because you mentioned yourself that this is not always a pleasant thing to do, but it's a necessary thing to do.
Well, it's amazing how much is thrown in our way to keep us from realizing, as John Taylor Gatto calls it, the active literacies. Now, Mr. Gatto himself didn't realize what constituted what he termed active literacy. He was referring a lot to rhetoric, but in fact, the active literacies are the trivium, are grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Or, as is stated in many of the so-called sacred texts of the world, learning, understanding, and wisdom. So learning is training. That's what Susan Weiss Bauer is talking about. This is, I'm using a lot of synonymous terms. It's a lot of people say that it's too bad that there are so many terms out there. But I find it an advantage at times. Training is didactic pedagogy. A big word for giving you the facts. Here it is. Or giving you a piece of imagination. Here it is. Here's an imaginative story. Let your brain do with it what it will. And now you go up to the well-educated mind, her second book, and educate comes from the, I believe it's the Latin, educere. I'm not certain as to what the pronunciation is, but it means to draw out. Now, training is getting the facts. To educate yourself, you are drawing out from the facts the deeper meaning. This is what education is. This is dialectic. This is your brain having a conversation with itself. Now, John Taylor Gatto just recorded the ultimate history lesson with a group of people that have an internet presence.
The Tragedy and Hope folks.
The Tragedy and Hope, but it's the Peace Revolution. Anyone can access by going to the Peace Revolution podcast. And so far, they've got three interviews with John Gatto out there. But John Gatto is known in the home education community as being an advocate of everyone having potential genius. And I agree with him. It's just activating these literacies, not taking the passive literacy of literal interpretation of words on a page. But now, especially as you reach the age where you can, during the age of development and puberty, drawing out from that what may be underneath. And this is where Susan Weiss Bauer gets into her education. All of this is also said in Dorothy Sayers' Lost Tools of Learning in a more compact fashion. But when you start the dialogue, and John Taylor Gatto evidently came to some of this later in his life as an adult, but in the very first episode of this Peace Revolution, The Ultimate History Lesson, one of the very first comments that he says is when he's trying to understand something, when he wants a deep understanding of what he feels he needs to know, he starts writing about it. It's exactly what you're saying, not copy work, but his own interpretation. He's putting it out on paper. He's putting his mind on paper. Well, what he's doing is having a dialogue with himself. So this is another trick. This is another thing that you can do as an adult or as an adolescent, as Jarrett Sanchez said, to put down your understanding on paper, to try to distill what's being said. Now, I have another personal story about this. It was before I reached puberty. I had an uncle who was very interested in mythology. He got me interested in comparative mythology. But our household was Christian, but he had wanted a deeper understanding of the origins of everything. So he became very friendly with some Jewish people, and they took us to a synagogue one afternoon. And the idea was that we were going to see a document there that was a copy of a manuscript. But the hook was that this was a 600-year-old document. So what got me interested is the United States was only 200 years old. And here was a piece of paper that was, or sheepskin, actually, it was vellum, that was copied 600 years ago. And so it was this piece of antiquity. So he walked in, and it wasn't a codex, it wasn't a book, it was a scroll. And if you looked at the two edges of the scroll, when we first looked at it, it was rolled up on one scroll, and you could see that the outer portion was a lighter color than a portion that was rolled up just underneath it was thinner, then the lighter color was thinner again, and finally the part that was right next to the scroll itself was a darker color. Well, it was written in, I'm not too sure if it was Hebrew or Aramaic, but most people understand that Hebrew is written from right to left. And what this is when you're copying, the reason it's written, there's a reason that it's written from right to left. It's because you're taking the word of nature, or the word, which is in my mind synonymous, the word of God, and bringing it into your heart. So nature is out here to your right-hand side, and you're bringing the word into your heart. So you're yes, toward you, from right to left. So that's how it's put on the page. Well, as we went forward, this was actually a treatise that first large portion was actually the treatise that was written previously. The next portion was the portion that was written by the scribe. It was his own interpretation. This is what Jarrett was referring to. He took the text and then made a lesser text in his own interpretation, and it was on the darker piece of vellum. And this was written from left to right. It was going from his heart back out to the natural world, back out to God. Here's my understanding of what you said. And then the next portion, the lighter portion, as we undid the scroll, was written from right to left. This was nature or God talking back to him so he could bring it into his heart. And then the final portion, the lesser, darker portion, was written from left to right. And what this was were the secrets of nature that he came to understand. And in the Jewish tradition, this is called Midrash. This is there are evidently some texts that belong in this bit of interpretive literature called Midrash, M-I-D-R-A-S-H. And it's a progression. I call it the Midrash progression. And this is exactly what Susan Weiss Bauer is saying, or what Jarrett Sanchez communicated, that
balanced that discussion.
Mortimer Adler. Well, what it is you take it in, then you give your own understanding, then you read it again, go back to what you've underlined.
Right.
Because you'll have you're engaging the plasticity of your own mind, if you have it, to get to the root of the thing, to finally get to the secrets of nature. And this is what life is about, is these active literacies.
Punctuating the point for why these types of exercises are important and beneficial.
Yeah. But let's go back. We're now in the transition between the grammar stage of life, or grammar. And I was relating the story of this dentist who became my mentor, not only in the science of dentistry itself, but gave me the liberating arts. He actually provided my understanding of what my mother had told me, what grammar was, and to continue going back to grammar. Now, some of these grammar books that he was telling me about that were related to dentistry were very advanced, but he still referred to them as grammar books. Go back to the grammar of head and neck anatomy. Go back to the grammar of dental materials. And so once I got the grammar into me, I now drew out from it my understanding. And the way he taught me to do this, and this was pretty close to the beginning of our relationship. I was tutored by him for a period of 8 years. But I think it was in the second year of my tutelage. The first year, he gave me this copy work to do with a dictionary. By the way, there's a popular movie out. It's fairly old now, but it's a Denzel Washington movie. It was a biographical outline of Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The story of Malcolm X. And one of the first things he does in his portrayal of Malcolm X, I think Malcolm X just gets out of prison, and he goes, he converts to Islam. And one of his tutors in the Islamic tradition tells him to get the dictionary and copy it. So this is a way of developing the plasticity of mind. I know that George Washington and Benjamin Franklin also did this. Many people did this back in the days before printing. Printing, of course, had already been invented by the time they came along. But their tutors, Franklin's and Washington's, knew the benefit of copy work, of developing this plasticity of mind. So this is, other than the space repetition of giving your child grammar at an early age, now we're up into, I'm age 13 or 14, and my mentor gets me to do some copy work. I really didn't care for it. So he says, okay, I'm going to give you a list of Aristotle's 10 categories. And Aristotle said, and as I say, any of your listeners can look this up on Wikipedia, and they're all listed right there. This is everything that Aristotle says can act as a subject and a predicate. It is a description of subject and predicate. So he gave me this list, and right next to it, he gave me something else. And he says, this is essentially the 10 categories, and it's a definition of existence. And that definition is, existence is every entity, action, or state of being, attribute, and relationship that is, was, or ever will be. Now, if you take that sentence and compare it to the 10 categories, you'll see that that is the whole of reality. Existence is every noun, verb, adjective, and adverb, prepositional phrase that exist in the three dimensions of time. That's it.
That's the summation of every religion, every spiritual belief that I think is out there today. That really is the point of all of them. If when I'm listening to it, that's what I'm feeling. I'm feeling that defines God. I mean, in an abstract way, I don't believe in God as a deity that exists outside of us, but that exists as part of who human beings are and what nature is. And that definition of existence is synonymous to me with the definition of being alive and existing, essentially, and who and what we are and what drives us.
Well, if you give it some thought over time, that is a summation of everything that is. It is the summation of existence. Now, each of us can hold that in our minds, and there are some people who can hold Aristotle's categories in their minds, but they can't utilize that entire idea by going back to the 10 categories. Now, it's useful to compare the 10 categories and to have an appreciation of Aristotle's mind for coming up with this idea, or at least expressing it in his time. And so you can see, again, where grammar is connected to dialectic or logic, because now I'm starting to understand how to use my mind to extract deeper meaning out of the data that I have, out of the grammar that I have. I'm starting to be able to take any contradictions. Now, the contradiction, if you're studying a particular developed subject, what are called formal subjects, like biology. Biology is formed to a high degree today. The life sciences are formed to a fairly high degree. They're almost self-intelligible. They one concept follows from the other, logic. One thing follows from the other. So a lot of times when you're teaching yourself or being taught biology, you have contradictions. The contradiction may not be in the written material itself, but it's in your understanding. So you've got to go in there and find the two-nosed man in your brain. Now, oftentimes, especially in the last several centuries, I must say, for science, things that are actually mythological have been pawned off as being science. And this leads us into some areas of the quadrivium, but it's number itself, which can be used very much like language, like letter in language can be used. Statistics can be made to say anything. But you have to have a plasticity of mind, the active literacies, to go in there and question. You mentioned the word question. Your last comments were actually going to what the situation in our world has been in the last several thousand years, and that is authority. The whole gist of things is that you accept an authority, that you not understand a particular subject or group of subjects, and go to an authority. Give up your plasticity of mind. Never mind your active literacy. The thing about active literacy is once it takes off within an individual, it's difficult to shut down. But before it starts up at puberty, it can be shut down quite effectively. And authorities over the ages, and I have a theory on that, which we don't want to go into right now, but authority is the thing that you're being led to. That's why schools are shutting our active literacies, our pursuit of the trivium, down.
So that we become submissive and malleable.
Exactly. Exactly. We don't become our own people.
Right. Which is why studying in this way and reintroducing this into our mind's capacity and our intellectual capacity is, in fact, liberating.
Yes. Liberation from ignorance so that you can go toward something, so that you can go toward knowledge and understanding on your own individual terms.
And this comes back to why when a teenager in their very natural human development goes through this stage of trying to understand and trying to see that two-nosed man and make sense of things in their life, this negativity has been brought upon that, and they're called rebellious and they're called troublemakers because we're actually trying to suppress that natural ability to challenge authority. We don't want... I'm using the pronoun we usually, but you know, it's done on purpose to kind of train that desire to challenge authority out of people.
Well, challenge may not be the optimum term. Question authority. Whenever an authority.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that. I can see where that would be a better term. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. You don't challenge it.
Right.
Challenge is an active. It can be confrontational, but if you have plasticity of mind, if you have the active literacies, if the trivium, all of these are synonymous as I'm using them, if that is within you, you can unilaterally, without going to the authority, you can unilaterally decide if that is a valid piece of information that authority is giving you, or is it deception? It's presented in two different ways.
I am currently finding myself, and not linearly, because there are different aspects of my life where I'm at different stages, of course, and it's all centrifugal or spherical, actually. But I would say that I have found myself in that stage, maybe where I'm challenging, or maybe in that adolescent stage, even though at my age I'm not a teenager, but intellectually and as I kind of grow in my own understanding of critical thinking, I may be in that stage. And I'm right now at this moment compelled to tell you that I'm inspired to change one of my taglines, change the wording from challenge to question, because I think what you're teaching me right now is very important. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. And again, the whole idea is, as Dorothy Sayers said toward the end of her essay. The whole idea is that we learn as individuals, as each individual, to learn for ourselves, to think for ourselves. So when you question authority, as I say, you can do this unilaterally. And there are many situations in life when you mentioned your pronoun we. A lot of times we think we need to do something, when in fact the first step, and it's only logical, is that I come to an understanding. And that's why questioning authority does not require a group of people. Now, you can discuss things, but the thing about question is, as distinct from challenge, is that it's up to you to come to the truth and validity of what that authority said. Now, I take things from authority all the time, but they're not that important to me. On the other hand, I found that if I flip on TV and I see a political debate going on, I want to watch the Cartoon Channel or something. Seriously.
Well, I mean, you know, it could be one and the same, really.
Yes, it is. It is.
It you might get more is. Out of the Cartoon Channel, actually.
Absolutely. I the only modern philosopher that I give a lot of credence to, and I know that you have mentioned that you have studied Ayn Rand's objectivism to a degree, and I give her credit. Actually, it was that sentence, that definition of existence, that drew me to study her, because her heir, Dr. Leonard Peikoff, has a number of recorded sessions. One is on the history of philosophy, which is excellent, but it's really biased to objectivism, to the philosophy of Ayn Rand, but he brings out that exact sentence. The only difference that I was given in that sentence, when it was given to me by my mentor, is rather than the word entity, which is a person, place, or thing, a noun, is he used the word substance. And what substance means is there is something that stands, either physically or mentally, but then there is the natural law, or the idea, or the design, if you will, behind it. And that is what is sub that which stands. So often when you hear nouns being described, they're called substantives. So this is matter and mind. This is all that exists. Matter would be that which stands. Sub is the natural law beneath it. And of course, because we are part of nature, of the universe, of all that is, we also have this capacity to co-create. So when you bring in co-creation, which is the capacity that we're trying to develop as humans, the capacity to have rational thought, which is the ability, the essential ability to see and use ratios. Now, whenever you discuss humans, you could say, and I get this from Dr. Leonard Peikoff, Ayn Rand's disciple, whenever you see a related point in reality, you're looking for the contradiction in your mind. So again, it's this, you mentioned a spherical structure. Ayn Rand uses the analogy of a spiral. Yeah. And this is exactly what we do with grammar, logic, and rhetoric, is we spiral from grammar up to logic, finally to rhetoric. Maybe we need a little bit more. We spiral back to grammar, mm-hmm. logic, rhetoric, until we have a full understanding of whatever it is.
I'm picturing, I'm drawing the mental picture in my mind of, you know, the children's toy, the spirograph, if you remember that. It was around when I was a kid. And that's kind of the picture that I'm conceptualizing there, where it's not something that happens where you're spiraling forward or you're spiraling backward. There is no point where you get to, okay, I'm going to progress and progress. I'm going to keep learning and I'm going to keep going. And that's why you have, I'm picturing that spirograph, because it kind of comes back in and on itself, just like the text or that were either written in Arabic or Hebrew that you're talking about. You're putting it out and you're coming back in, and it's the same way. You're starting with grammar, going up to logic and rhetoric, and coming back to grammar. And this is a continual, a perpetual process. And I guess that's why I called it spherical also, is because it's perpetual. It's not where you start at A and then you get to Z and you've graduated, you're done. It's kind of like a perpetual thing as we live and as we grow.
Yes.
And the more we learn and the more we're able to nail down and really cement, more lines are drawn in that spirograph. And I guess, you know, the older we get, the more lines a person has, hopefully, if they have that ability in them, you know. What I'm going to do right now, Gene, and I'm seeing that we're running out of time, but I've decided that the audience and I in the world haven't heard enough from you. So I'd like to officially invite you to come back for a part two and possibly part three, because I know that I haven't covered everything that I'd like to cover with you. We haven't really finished out talking about the logic stage in kids or really with adults and then rhetoric. And I wanted to talk about some of the different programs that are out there. So if you can come back for a part two and we can kind of publish this in parts, maybe even three parts, that would be great, because I think that we have a lot more important and relevant discussion to have.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
All right, folks, thanks for listening. This is Laurette Lynn, your host of Unplugged Mom Radio. For more information, visit unpluggedmom.com. Thank you so much for listening to Grammar. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed conducting the interview. This is going to turn out to be a phenomenal series, and I hope that you will continue to listen. The next installment coming up is Logic. That stage is also known as the Understanding stage. So you're going to want to tune in for that. That's coming up very soon. Stay tuned, and don't forget, for more information, just go to unpluggedmom.com to learn anything you need to know. Thank you again for listening to Unplugged Mom Radio. This is Laurette Lynn saying bye-bye.